Jacob Wolf was a great bull of a man, with broad shoulders and a barrel chest that wouldn't have looked out of place on a professional gladiator. He wore his hair cropped close to his skull, maintained his face as that of a man in his 40s, and ignored all fashions as they came and went. His jaw jutted always forward, as though daring anyone to comment. His eyes were dark and piercing, and it was a point of honor to him that he never looked away first. He had hands like mauls, large and blocky, curled most often into fists, and his voice was a growl. The wolf had put a lot of time and thought into the image he projected, and he was quietly pleased with the result. It let people know right from the start that he was not a man to be trifled with. The wolf was 103 years old, but thanks to imperial science, the young man sitting opposite him could easily have been mistaken for his brother rather than his son. Even so, a stranger would have found it hard to detect any family resemblance between them. Valentine Wolf was tall, slender, and darkly delicate, like a hothouse flower rudely torn from its usual habitat. His face was long and thin, and more than fashionably pale, and his shock of jet-black hair fell to his shoulders in curls and ringlets. Heavy mascara highlighted his overbright eyes, and a painted crimson smile hid his feelings from one and all. He had an artist's hands, all long, slender fingers and languorous gestures, and they fluttered about his throat in moments of excitement, like startled doves in the night. Valentine Wolf was well known in and out of court for having tried every drug known to man, and a few he'd had made up specially. If you could smoke it, sniff it, or stick it where the sun doesn't shine, he'd tried it all once, and twice if he enjoyed it, which he usually did. It was truly said he'd never met a chemical he didn't like. It was a wonder to all who knew him that he hadn't fried his brains long ago. But by some dark chemical miracle, his mind remained sharp and dangerous. He had the usual enemies for a man in his position, and looked like he would outlive them all. And though he chose not to play the game of intrigue himself, he could still be a subtle and malevolent influence on those who did. Valentine might be a hothouse flower, but his thorns were poisonous. He produced a tab from a silver pillbox and pressed it against the side of his neck, over the main vein. His painted smile widened like a scarlet wound. His father sniffed disapprovingly.
"Do you have to do that now? We'll be at court soon, and we're both going to need all our wits about us."
"It's just a little something to take the edge off, Father. Rest assured that all my many resources are at your disposal. If I was any more alert, my synapses would be going into meltdown. Why do you suppose Her Imperial Majesty, long may she reign, desires our company this time?"
"Who knows why the Iron Bitch does anything these days? I've spent more time traveling back and forth in these damn death traps this last week than I'd normally expect in a month. She's not following any of her usual patterns, and all my usual sources have either disappeared into the woodwork or developed unexpected scruples. I've been paying the little turds good money for years, and just when I really need them, they fold on me. Assuming I make it back from court in one fairly large piece, heads are going to roll, boy, and I am not being metaphorical. She's planning something. Something she knows the Company of Lords won't approve of. So she's doing all this just to keep us distracted and separated. It's a smokescreen, sleight of hand. But hiding what? Pay attention, boy. One of these days, loath though I am to admit it, you're going to have to take over from me as head of the family. And I won't have it said I didn't do everything in my power to ready you for that."
"Far away may that time be, Father. You do so much for me, and I never appreciate it. I have a few trifles about me that are said to boost intellect and liberate the mind. Would you care to try a little something?"
"No, I would not. I've never needed drugs to be smart. Show me how smart you are. Why do you think the bitch wants to see us this time?"
Valentine drew a flower from his sleeve. It had a long stem bristling with thorns, and its thick, pulpy petals were black as night. He sniffed the flower appreciatively, then took one petal between his perfect teeth and pulled it free. He ate the petal slowly, savoring the juices.
"The Empress has been most disturbed of late, ever since news came in of two newly discovered alien species outside the Empire, with technologies at least the equal of our own.
One would have been enough as a potential threat, but the prospect of two such species seems to have practically unhinged the poor deer. Then there's the cyber rats playing their disruptive little games on our computers, the clone underground spreading its proclamations everywhere you look, and let us not forget the elves, bless their black little hearts. The elves have been growing increasingly arrogant, not to mention successful in their attacks of late. And of course there are always the endless court intrigues with their plots and schemes and intricate designs. Some days at court you don't dare cough or scratch your ear for fear someone will take it as a sign to start something violent. Still, you don't need me to tell you that, Father. The wolf smiled briefly. It was not a pretty sight.
So, you have been paying attention at least. They're all good answers, but which one would you pick? Where does the real danger lie for the Empress and for us?
Valentine Wolf ate another black petal, chewing thoughtfully. Bright spots of color glowed on his pale cheeks like badly applied rouge, and his dark eyes saw many things.
The aliens are too distant a threat to be worrying our dear Majesty yet. Perhaps we should just introduce the aliens to each other, and then stand well back while they fight it out.
The cyber-rats are too few and far between to be anything but a nuisance, and the clone underground lacks the funding necessary to emerge as a real political force. And the elves have been surprisingly quiet these past few days. Obviously, that won't last, but I would have to say they've done nothing outrageous enough just recently to justify our dear Majesty's abrupt summons. No, I fear it's more simple than that. Dear Lionstone has caught someone upstanding with his pants down, or his hand in the till, and she wants us to watch and take notes while she has something extremely unpleasant and instructive done to him. Le Mirdam sans merci, Our Lady of Pain, the Iron Bitch. Jacob Wolf nodded slowly and flexed his great muscles.
Good. That's more like it. One of us is going to get the chop, and she wants us there to witness it and be reminded where the real power at court lies. Nothing new there, except that for once, I don't have a clue as to who it might be. And that is strange. There's usually some whisper going round where my agents can overhear it. So watch yourself when we get to court, boy. Keep your mouth shut and your veins clear, and take your lead from me.
Of course, Father.
Valentine finished the last petal and began to chew slowly at the stem, ignoring the thorns. A thin trickle of saliva mixed with blood ran down his chin as he smiled, and Jacob Wolf looked away. The antechamber to the Imperial Court was grand enough in its own right to put any other court to shame. A huge open chamber of gleaming steel and brass, it stretched away in every direction for as far as the eye could comfortably see. The vista broken here and there by tall, intricately worked pillars of gold and silver, set at regular intervals as much for the effect as anything else. And still the packed crowd filled the antechamber from wall to distant wall. Everyone who was anyone, or thought they might be, came to court when the Empress held audience to shake the hand of those in favor or snub those who weren't, to make family agreements or business deals, or just to be seen at court by the billions watching on their hollow screens throughout the empire. All the families were there, the cream of the aristocracy, carefully keeping a respectful distance between themselves and sworn enemies, or simply those of discernibly lower status. Holograms stood to one side, nodding politely to each other, given away by the occasional faint shimmering as some security field interrupted the signal for a moment. Forbidden by law and custom from speaking or drawing attention to themselves, they drifted among the gorgeous lords and ladies like ghosts at the feast. The families conversed quietly as they waited, searching for support or one-upmanship or simply the latest gossip. Heavily armed guards stood here and there, ostentatious in their scarlet armor and visored faces. No one paid them any attention. The families knew that they were being watched and that the guards were only the most obvious part of it. Mostly, they were just there to ensure the peace among feuding clans. None of the families were allowed bodyguards or weapons of any kind, but when words grew heated, blows often followed. And then the guards would move in and restore order with savage gusto. It wasn't often a low-born guard got the chance to manhandle a lord, and they intended to make the most of it. So the guards watched and waited, and the wolves kept away from the Campbells, who kept away from the Shreks, and so on and so on.
Open violence was so gauche, after all.
Lord Crawford Campbell, head of his clan, moved slowly among the families with bright eyes and a wide smile, like a shark maneuvering in a shoal of lesser fish. He was less than average height and more than average weight, and didn't give a damn. The Campbells always maintained that the greatness of a man could be seen in the breadth of his appetites, and Crawford Campbell was well known for his many indulgences. He was well over 100, but modern science kept his face as full and unmarked as a child's, none of which did anything to blunt the man's intellect, which remained razor-sharp and just as dangerous. The Campbells were in favor at court for the moment, not least because the Campbell had sacrificed so many others who stood in his way. Not that anyone could prove anything, of course. The customs and protocols had to be observed. People nodded respectfully to the Campbell as he passed, and gave him plenty of room. He took it as his due. And if sometimes a lesser lord or lady showed a different face to his back, Crawford Campbell never gave a damn. He didn't have to. Drifting at his side or in his wake, like a multicolored bird of paradise, was Crawford's eldest son and heir, Finlay Campbell, dressed as always in the brightest silks and graces current styles allowed. Tall and graceful and fashionable to the moment, from his polished thigh boots to his velvet cap, Finlay glided among the lords and ladies with a smile and a nod and a polite murmur, allowing himself to be seen by as many as possible. He might have been handsome beneath the cosmetics that made a mask of his face, but it was almost impossible to tell. The current mode called for fluorescent skin that glowed a shimmering silver and shoulder-length metallic hair, every strand individually coated with whatever metals were currently in favor. He wore a cutaway frock coat that showed off his exquisite figure, and a pair of pince-nez spectacles that he didn't need, and every pose he struck was the epitome of grace and style. Finlay Campbell was a dandy and a fop, and though he wore a sword on all occasions when fashion demanded it, he had never been known to draw it in anger. No one ever drew on him, of course, because he was a Campbell after all, and you could never be sure with them. His father had given up disowning him because it didn't work, but made no secret of the contempt he held for the fancy poet who had somehow sprung from his manly loins. Even so, no one ever intrigued against Finlay. The Campbell was deadly enough for both of them, and would brook no insult to the family name. Crawford Campbell worked the crowd with ease, nodding to those in his favor or the Empress's, and cutting dead everyone else with glorious scorn. Though his movements seemed random, he was in fact quartering the chamber with military precision, making sure he saw everyone who mattered and marking their face and position in his memory. It was important to know who had come to court and who had not, or sent a hollow in their place. Knowledge was everything in the cut-and-thrust politics of Lionstone's court. The Campbell approved when he thought about it. A certain genteel savagery helped to weed out the weak and the timid. His gaze suddenly lightened as it fell upon a familiar but uncommon face, and he strode briskly through the crowd, giving people just enough time to get out of his way, if they were quick.
Summerisle, my dear fellow! A pleasure to see you, as always. What brings you to court?
Lord Roderick Summerisle bowed formally in return. Against the current fashion, he showed his true age in his lined face and thick white hair, though his back was still straight and he held his head high. The Summerisle disapproved of the current court almost as much as it disapproved of him, and he was rarely seen in public. He dressed in the formal style of the previous emperor, even though it was forbidden, and kept dangerous company. No one ever said anything. The Summerisle had been a master duelist in his day, and no one was at all sure that day was over. He smiled at the Campbell almost reluctantly and took the proffered hand.
Campbell, looking as disreputable as ever, I see. Still in favor? Of course, silly question. It's been years since I last found it necessary to attend court, but some things never change. Virtue still goes unrewarded, and the scum still rises to the top.
Campbell grinned.
You never did approve of me, Summerisle. Lucky we're friends, or we'd have killed each other years ago.
Oh, I doubt it. You were never that good with a sword.
Campbell produced a sudden bark of laughter, and people who'd been edging closer to eavesdrop quickly moved away again. It was said by many, and believed by most, that the Campbell sense of humor was more dangerous than his rage. Campbell and Summerisle had been rivals since they were born, and down the long years had been surprised to find it was easier to like an enemy they admired than an ally who had to be supported for family reasons. The rogue and the honest man, friends despite themselves, bound as tightly as only opposites can be. Campbell fixed Summerisle with a thoughtful stare and moved a little closer.
"What does bring you here after all these years? I thought you decided politics were for the lower orders, like myself."
"My opinion of this court has not changed one iota. You are the living proof, Campbell. How many battermen have you trampled underfoot to reach your present position?"
"I stopped counting. It was starting to make me big-headed."
Summerisle shook his head slowly.
"You are everything I despise in this court, and I am everything you sought to stamp out in your long career of murder and double-dealing. What do we have in common?"
"Dead enemies, mostly. We've survived because we've outlived everyone who tried to kill us. We've seen emperors come and go, and the empire spread 100-fold. Political parties rise and fall, businesses bloom and wither. But we go on, matchless and unstoppable. Who else could we talk to who've seen what we've seen, fought as we have fought? Personally, I like you because you don't take any shit from anyone, especially me. As for you, you value the truth where you hear it, even if you don't like what it's telling you. You know where you are with me, Rod."
Summerisle smiled briefly.
"You always did talk too much, Crawford. How are your sons?"
"A pain in the ass, as always. All married off at last and producing grandchildren, but otherwise no bloody use at all. I swear Finley is trying to achieve suicide or martyrdom through sheer excess of fashion. Sometimes I wish he would, just so he'd stop embarrassing me. If he wasn't my eldest, I'd have him smothered in his sleep. There were 6 others ahead of him. Good boys all. But they all died from duels or treachery or politics of some kind. They're gone, and I'm left with Finley as heir. If the gene test hadn't proved he was mine, I'd swear his mother stepped out on me. And the others are worse, if you can believe that. My blood must have been running thin when I fathered that batch. At least Finley has a mind of his own, even if he doesn't use it much."
Campbell stopped and looked unhappily at Summerisle. His voice became low and gruff.
"I heard about your son's death. He should never have fought that duel. He didn't stand a chance."
"No, he didn't. But he had no choice. Honor demanded it."
"You haven't answered my question yet. What has brought you back to court after all your years of self-imposed exile?"
"Her Majesty summoned me with a personal note in her own handwriting. Said she had someone she wanted me to meet. How could I say no?"
"I would have. When Lionstone starts taking a personal interest in you, it's time to change your name and head for the rim."
Campbell scowled thoughtfully.
"What does the Iron Bitch want with you?"
"She didn't say. Just that my presence was required at this audience. It doesn't matter. My wife is dead, and all my sons. All I have left is my grandson, Kit. And we don't get on. And I'm too old to be frightened. So, here I am, a loyal subject of Her Majesty."
Campbell's loud bark of laughter turned a few heads, but only briefly. The space around him and Summerisle was growing.
"Your loyalty has always been to the throne, not whoever happened to be sitting on it. I don't think you've had a good word to say about Lionstone since she stabbed her nanny when she was 6.
"Oh, I don't know. I've got a very good word for Lionstone. Only I'm too much of a gentleman to use it."
He waited patiently for Campbell's laughter to subside.
"Her father was a hard man to love, if not to follow, but I never doubted he had the well-being of the Empire at heart. Lionstone cares for nothing and no one save herself. She's a spoiled brat, and always has been. Which is not exactly unusual in royal stock, but bearable when diluted with some sense of duty. We've seen many royal backsides on the imperial throne, Crawford, but I honestly fear for the Empire under Lionstone 14.
Get out of here, Rod. Whatever the Iron Bitch has to say to you, I don't think either of us wants to hear it. Nothing good will come of it. Leave now, while you still can.
Where would I go? Where could I go where Her Majesty's hounds wouldn't drag me down sooner or later? I never ran from an enemy before, and I'm not about to start now. She's brought me here to kill me, I know that. But I will end my days with dignity, as a loyal subject before his monarch. Even if that monarch is not worthy of that loyalty.
Very pretty. It'll look great on your tombstone. Why make it easy for her?
It's called duty, Crawford. You must have heard of it. When honor calls, a man must make his stand. If he is a man.
As you wish, Summerisle. Just don't stand too close to me while you're doing it.
They shared a brief smile, and then looked round sharply as the great double door swung smoothly open, the massive slabs of beaten steel gliding back as though they weighed nothing. A long fanfare rang out, silencing the chatter of the courtiers, and bright lights spilled out from the great courtroom of Lionstone the 14th. The courtiers moved toward it in fits and starts, like moths drawn to a flame. First went the company of lords, all those of the first 100 families of the Empire, those who ruled planets or companies or armies by right of succession in the Empress's name, the highest of the high, most noble and acclaimed of Her Majesty's subjects. In theory, at least. They strode into the great courtroom, looking neither left nor right, their heads high. Secretly, they felt naked without their usual retinues of bodyguards, advisers, and sycophants, but a lord came alone to meet his empress, without even a sword on his hip. It was a sign of trust and respect, not to mention imperial paranoia. And after them came the 250 members of Her Majesty's Parliament. They represented the economic forces in the Empire, the power and influence of the mighty credit. Only those with a high enough income were allowed to vote, of course. Unless one was of noble birth, Parliament was the only way to gain access to the inner circles of government. A member of Parliament might be obliged to bow to a lord if they met in the street, but in an audience with the Empress, their voices were equal. If the members were ever to act in unison, they could have brought the company of lords to heel like so many unruly dogs. But the Parliament was split into several opposing factions, and the lords took care to keep it split through quiet patronage and the occasional large bribe. Of late, Parliament had been increasingly disturbed over the threat of higher taxes to pay for the expansion of the Imperial fleet to face the possible threat from the two newly discovered alien species. In theory, the Empress was bound by law and custom to abide by whatever decisions Parliament and the Company of Lords could bring themselves to agree on. In practice, the Empress would listen when she was in the mood, and then make up her own mind. Lionstone had the backing of the army and the fleet, and as long as she did, no one could make her do a damn thing she didn't want to. Which was why the prospect of an enlarged and more powerful fleet was causing a lot of sweaty hands and sleepless nights among Parliament and the Lords. Some members had been heard to say they didn't believe in the new aliens, but as yet no one was prepared to say that in public, let alone at court. But on the other hand, Lionstone's position was not as powerful as it had once been. A great many younger sons of the aristocracy, unable to inherit a title, had ended up making careers for themselves in the army and the fleet. And as they advanced in rank, so their influence grew, so that the army and the fleet were no longer the unquestioning servants they had once been. All of which meant that the political structure at court was one of complete chaos, over which the Empress presided through canny politicking and sheer force of personality. After the members of Parliament came the bulk of the crowd, family members, political hangers-on, businessmen and officers, and anyone else who could bribe, beg, or steal an invitation. And finally, right at the back, in hard-worn clothes with hard-worn faces, came the 10 commoners who'd won the imperial lottery that year. They had won the right to visit the court and petition the Empress in person for her aid or charity or justice. Of course, actually raising your voice at court was a risky business, A commoner had no friends there, and sometimes it was better if the Empress didn't notice you. On the whole, lottery winners tended just to enjoy the occasion. Some spent the whole year at court and never did ask their question. The court itself was a swamp this time. Thick curls of mist hung on the humid air between gnarled and twisted trees, and everywhere was at least ankle-deep in dark, smelly water. Knotted vines hung down from lowering branches to trail in the water, and the air was thick with flies and other insects. The courtiers splashed doggedly on through the swamp, keeping a wary eye open for crocodiles or other unpleasantness that might be lurking in the deepening muddy water. Just because it wasn't a real swamp didn't mean there weren't real dangers to be found in it. Most of it was holograms with just enough physical reality here and there to make it authentically uncomfortable. Lionstone liked to keep her court interesting, and her tastes were both devious and wide-ranging. In the past, she'd turned her court into a desert, an arctic waste, and an inner-city slum. That one had been really dangerous, and everyone had suffered from fleas afterward. The courtiers slogged on, muttering darkly, their mood not helped by the knowledge that the whole empire was watching them suffer. Every planet, no matter how poor or how far-flung, had access to the workings of the court, thanks to the artfully concealed holocameras. The lords and the members swore every year that they were going to put a stop to the ancient custom, but somehow they never did. No one could resist the thought of so large a watching audience. Every now and again, a gleaming silver statue would appear out of the mists, fashioned to show the form of one of the many alien species that had been brought into the empire and taught their place. There were a hell of a lot of them. No one knew exactly how many. No one really cared. Some of the statues had actually outlasted the species they represented. There weren't many who cared about that either. It was, after all, first and foremost, a human empire. Some of the older courtiers leaned on the statues to get their breath back, after first checking for booby traps. The Empress sat casually on a great throne of black iron and gleaming jade, set just high enough to keep her feet out of the water. She looked perfectly at ease, even though the throne had obviously been designed for someone rather larger. The mists curled away from where she sat, calm and comfortable in her own little circle of cool air. She looked cold and regal and perfect in her royal robes and diamond crown, every inch an empress. Her maids-in-waiting crouched naked in the muddy waters at the base of the throne, like so many hunting dogs straining at unseen leashes. The courtiers slowly assembled before the throne, careful to maintain a respectful and safe distance, and bowed to their empress. She looked down at the hundreds of bowed heads and yawned. The courtiers stayed bent over, hot and sweating, waiting to be released. Once she'd kept them there for an hour,